Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday morning. It's a snowy day, but that didn't stop our crew from coming in. We're thrilled to have them and thrilled to introduce them to you. It's the 2nd of March, and here we are. So let me introduce you to corporate attorney Rich Honan, who joins us, drove in from Voorheesville, made it. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want me to give the I'll give the mailing address if you'd like.
Phone right. Number.
P-O-box. Yeah,
right. It's a hardened target.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. Washington County in the house. Aaron Pasidi is here. He is a economics professor. We go through this. Economics?
Economics.
Yeah. Economics professor at Siena College. And you made it in, as I did, from Washington County. Yeah. And, a little rough, but not too bad.
A big shout out to the Cambridge Highway Department.
They're amazing.
They are.
They're absolutely amazing. Judith Enk is here, former EPA administrator, wrote me this past hour and said, I will be there. I have a Subaru. And I wrote her back and I said, I will see you there. So do I. Perfect cars for this region. Are there better cars for this region than a Subaru?
Our family always has to have a Subaru. Sorry about the announcement. I wish it was an electric, but it's not. But when you live on top of a mountain on a dirt road, you need a good car.
Well, and while perhaps not the most environmentally friendly of cars, it's certainly socially and progressively as a darn good
and good
brand.
Mileage.
Very good mileage. So
your next one should be a Tesla.
Yeah,
they're great in the snow. That's why they all have them in Norway. Life.
Plus, there might be tariffs on Subarus in the next couple of years.
They'll all be on bicycles.
Only if they're made out of steel.
All right. Well,
and it begins.
And that's right. And it begins. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. My thanks to everybody for coming in. I really appreciate it for making it in the snow and
anything
and being
for
here.
You, Joe.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to have you
and
here.
Siena has a snow day too, so I'm coming in just for this.
I know.
Thanks.
Well, which just makes no sense. But I thank you very much. It's very sweet of you.
Do I get double pay for this?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. double of free is well, okay.
Yeah, still zero.
You're the professor. All right. So a lot of stuff canceled today. A lot of stuff postponed because of the snow. And I don't have to be the 28th person to tell you to take it easy. But so just sit back, relax, listen to us for a while, and hopefully we'll
lull you into a coma and you can go back to bed.
What a week. A lot going on. We'll begin with the Trump tariffs. This is the story that all of our panel members were just alluding to. President Trump said on Thursday that he would impose stiff tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum, making good on a key campaign promise and rattling stock markets as the prospect of a global trade fight appeared imminent. Trade wars are good and easy to win, he tweeted the next morning. Is that true? Do we know that?
No.
Okay.
They're not.
In a hastily arranged meeting with industry executives that stunned many inside the West Wing, you wonder what stuns anyone in the West Wing
right.
at this point, but Mr. Trump said he would formally sign the trade measures next week and promise they would be in effect, quote, for a long period of time. The action, which came against the wishes of Mr. Trump's pro-trade advisors, would impose tariffs of 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum, effectively placing a tax on every foreign shipment of those metals into the United States. The president told more than a dozen executives that he wanted the tariffs to apply to all countries. One executive in attendance said, Mr. Trump argued that if one country was exempt, all others would line up to ask for similar treatment, and that metals could end up being shipped to the United States through exempted countries. All right. Let's go to Aaron first.
So this is interesting but kind of unsurprising because it's the, I don't know, I think it's the basest way to deal with international trade. So interestingly, he invoked the National Security Clause of tariffs, which I'm not seeing, and there hasn't been any formal legal review of this proposal yet. So to say he's going to have it in by next week seems optimistic at best. So the whole point of the tariffs is to protect domestic industries by essentially raising the price of imported goods, which lowers the quantity that come in, and therefore U.S. producers and consumers substitute domestically made goods. But the risk anytime tariffs are imposed is that they're not going to go unnoticed by other countries. So you will see tariffs that not necessarily will be reciprocal on steel and aluminum, but targeting U.S. exporters like the agricultural industry. So this has the potential to bleed outside of steel and aluminum to a lot of other different sectors. And I think the key point to make here is that steel and aluminum are major inputs to a lot of different goods. So it's going to raise the cost to U.S. consumers of things like cars, planes, you know, canned food, beer. And it's, you know, Gary Cohn understands this and has threatened to resign about this. So this is really bad policy that's going to create a lot of unnecessary volatility in an already volatile market. And this is not going to be a win for U.S. workers. It's not going to be a win for U.S. producers.
Rich, how much of that do you agree with? And talk a little bit about the volatility in the market and how long-lasting that you think that will be.
I didn't think yes, the market reacted negatively, but these days, you know, 400 points is what, you know,
right.
You know 1% or say, or you know, something like that. And it's also in the mix of other economic news that, you know, perversely is good news that is making people worry a little bit about inflation. Although Powell said that he didn't see a lot of upward pressure on wages, which makes you think that inflation that there's only going to be kind of the three raises. I have to take issue with the gratuitous line in the article that stunned many in the West Wing. That had to be the New York Times, right? That said that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. So a responsible paper wouldn't start with that stunned many. Show me the five people that stunned. I mean, Cohn, they've been arguing
Gary
about
Cohn.
This. Open, no, but he...
In the announcement, the announcement, there were people that were just like an owl.
He was not planning on making this announcement.
Who was that?
He did campaign on this, and his staff and advisors have been trying to talk him out of it, and I think he tried to kind of divert attention from other news yesterday and kind of blurted this out. And it's actually not going to be final until next year. But I agree with Rich. This really should not be a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, say what you want about the guy, but there's not a heck of a lot of what he has said or done that he didn't talk about ad nauseum on the campaign trail. So if somebody was stunned, I think they're in the wrong job.
But normally big policies like this are discussed with economic advisors and planned and have at least a preliminary legal review before it's announced unexpectedly in a meeting with steel and aluminum executives.
But the legal review, it's not going to be found illegal. It's not going to be found to
a... Well, the World Trade Organization might.
Do we care what the World Trade Organization thinks? I mean, I think that's the idea, right? That's one of the problems. Moving to the substance of it, I mean, you know, everything Aaron says is correct. It's going to... the only part I would add to that is, it will have the effect of raising prices. But one of the problems is, you know, this whole, you know, we've all been latching on to globalism, but globalism basically makes it's a closed system. It's a really big system, but it's a closed system. So if, you know, we are paying our workers $40 an hour, you know, fully burdened to make steel, and they're paying their people 10 cents a week, they're going to be able to make cheaper steel. And we need our workers... you know, say they need protection there.
Not to divert from the issue, but how about this language?
Okay.
Okay. Since he became president, Donald Trump's threats to sanction global trading partners sent tremors through business-oriented congressional Republicans worried about how potential retaliation from abroad could reverberate through the business, through businesses and farms in their districts. That rattle turned into an earthquake yesterday.
You know, traditional Republicans have been tremoring, you know, ever since.
But my point is, that's the Wall Street Journal.
Okay. So the Wall Street Journal is as against Trump on these things as is the New York Times. Read the editorials in the Journal. They are very against the whole tariff thing. Every time he crosses party lines, the Wall Street Journal, you know, really kind of loses its mind.
I was just getting at you regarding the responsibility of the newspaper. I would say that most press agencies are sort of on the
what? Irresponsible side?
Judith, what do you think?
I'm not sure this is a bad idea. And I'll tell you why. I mean, years ago, we had a vibrant domestic steel industry here. And as Rich says, a lot of American manufacturing left because these companies have fled to countries that don't pay workers a living wage, that don't comply with environmental regulations. And I don't think it's a bad thing to try to promote domestic steel. You know, we're all encouraged to buy locally. And from an environmental perspective, you know, shipping products from China to the United States uses a lot of energy. It's not good from a climate change perspective. So I think if this tariff is matched with an honest-to-goodness commitment to build a domestic steel industry back up, to, for instance, do an infrastructure plan that includes high-speed rail, which will include a demand for steel. I know I'm in the minority, but, you know, quite honestly, I'd like to see a tariff on plastic. I'd like to see some environmental consideration on free trade. So, you know, I don't expect this is going to last. The president announced it quite quickly, as you said yesterday. It has to be finalized next week. I think the free traders are going to pound him over the weekend. But I'd actually like to give this a try. I think this is an opportunity to get some domestic jobs. I know, Aaron, you're going to say that the net is bad because the steel, you know, industries that use steel will suffer. Consumer prices will go up. But a more vibrant domestic manufacturing base that I think is good for workers and good for the environment.
I totally agree with that. But the point is that any gains you have in creating a more vibrant manufacturing base are going to be offset by job losses of industries that get retaliation with tariffs imposed upon them.
Right.
So
lead to a really unfortunate trade war. I agree.
So I think the bigger issue here is the past 40 years of corporate-sponsored globalization, where it's been direct U.S. economic policy to pit specifically manufacturing workers with low-wage manufacturing workers in other countries. So the big one was the permanent normal trading relations with China that Clinton passed in 1999. There's been a strong dollar policy that makes imports cheaper and U.S. exports more expensive. There's been a very consistent anti-worker international trade policy that the U.S. government has been imposing, really beginning since Reagan. And rewriting some of those trade laws, I think gets to the root of the matter a lot faster than, you know, pointing out steel and aluminum as being part of that. And we need I totally agree with you. We need some type of industrial policy of subsidizing and directing funds to industries that have some strategic economic advantage, like manufacturing, more importantly, you know, things like clean energy. But this is not getting at the root of the problem. The root of the problem has been the, you know, corporate-sponsored global trade policy that's been in effect for four decades, and this is not going to have any major effect on changing that.
But it will give you effect. It does give the United States leverage in an area that didn't have a lot of leverage, because if you weren't imposing tariffs before, you didn't have anywhere to negotiate from. And if we've learned nothing else about Trump, we've learned that, you know, he sets the goal way, way out to some unreasonable spot, and then he usually comes back actually to some area of you know, something close to reasonability. Once you get through the rhetoric and everything, where you actually end up on most policies is not terribly far off from mainstream in many ways. But when you don't have a tariff, you can't go anywhere from there. And I think he's like everything. I think he's building himself some leverage, and he's sending a message. And I think the markets will roil a little bit, but that's short term.
Let's talk about what you said a moment ago, which is the diversionary tactic here of you got a lot going on. So did this plate spinning take our eyes off the other stuff?
Yeah, for instance. Russia, where not just the investigation, but Putin did a video yesterday, with a nice map of Florida on it. It's fascinating that the president well, it's not fascinating. It's predictable that the president did not say a peep about the Russian offensive yesterday. And yet this morning he's tweeting about Alec Baldwin's appearance on Saturday Night Live. And he's in a little Twitter war with Alec Baldwin. He's spending his time on that. You know, you can go through the list. I mean, I think the Jared Kushner financial entanglement with his bank loans. And last night there was media reports that the FBI is investing Ivanka Trump. It's a lot going on. So I think this was a little bit of a diversion as we're used to.
Yeah, I think a lot of the tweets are diversionary. I think this was more. I think the tariff is much more policy based.
Right.
I mean, that's a real thing, and it has an effect.
It is a real thing, but by all accounts, it was done really hastily.
What are you going to wait for a quiet day in the Trump White House to get something done?
Good point.
Tell me when that day comes.
I'm worried that it's snowing hard in Washington today. The federal government and the schools are closed. What kind of tweets are we going to see throughout the day? I mean, watch Fox News and then you'll see the tweets. Today's a very dangerous day in Washington.
I mean, the fascinating thing to me about this is when Trump picked his cabinet, he was picking, you know, people who were very pro-globalization in its current form.
Yep.
And I don't know if, you know, people like Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn thought that they could talk sense into Trump. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the fact that he's just saying this against, you know, all of his pro-free trade.
Wilbur Ross is all about this, right?
When he's awake.
Okay.
The thing about Cohen, though, not to cut you off.
No, you're right,
The thing about
Rich.
Cohen is he's like the Marco Rubio of the administration. You know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do
this,
and then he doesn't.
I thought Sessions was the punching bag.
Well, Sessions is in a. I love the dinner the other night with the three of them. He's in a whole different category. But how many months have we been hearing that this is it? You know, I remember when President Trump did the comments on after the tragedy in Virginia, and you know, like the really truly troubling comments, and Gary Cohen was standing right next to him, and I thought, well, if this doesn't send him to the exits, I don't know what will, but he's still there.
The profitability of Goldman Sachs might.
Yeah, well, that's where Dina Powell went right back to the revolving door.
And then you have the talk about that, and then you have the talk about H.R. McMaster. You have the talk. I mean, there's a lot of people who seem to be, Kelly, of course, you know, who people are eyeing the door.
Well, one in three White House staff have left in the past year. That's a phenomenal turnover rate. It's a high burnout job, but to lose a third of your White House staff
in a year.
He
also has his patience is more based on kind of a corporate patience quotient than a political patience quotient, you know, where, you know, politically you kind of let people kind
of good or bad.
I don't know. I think it's good, but that's because I'm impatient on everything. I think if somebody's not working out, you move them out. And I think they made some bad calls in the beginning.
All right. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have letters and we'll talk about other stuff. We have a great panel. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. We've had some very vibrant conversation during the break. We got a lot done, I think.
We're out of here.
We tried to cancel a $31,000 dining set order, but other than that, we weren't good on that one. But everything else we did.
Hardwood, you're killing me, Ben Carson.
but everything else, I think we accomplished a lot during the break. We'll try to bring you up to date as we move on. We have some letters regarding the tariff issue, and then we will and then I want to get to guns and some other stuff here in just a moment. Skip writes to us and says, "Hi, esteemed panel." Hello, esteemed Skip. Doesn't Congress have any input into the tariff issue, or is it implemented by decree?
Congress can pass a bill to override it, but they won't because they want their judges.
Mark says there is no such thing as free trade. Capital is much more internationally mobile than labor, and this will inevitably create market distortions. Trade liberalization is not a progressive posture.
I 100% agree with that. What's been labeled as free trade over the past four decades has been heavily managed trade to favor certain elite interests, namely international investors, holders of international intellectual property. That's not free trade. There are huge restrictions that the U.S. places on specifically intellectual property certain sectors like manufacturing have been liberalized in terms of competing with foreign suppliers, but other industries like the medical profession, you've seen increased licensing requirements about what it takes to become a practicing doctor. So it's not free trade, it's just managed trade.
Yeah, and to what end? On the intellectual property side, I mean, you know, there's basically no intellectual property protection in, you know, in China or most of Asia for you know, American products.
But patents are the biggest form of government regulation. It's a government-guaranteed monopoly. And I'm not saying you can argue that's good or bad, but there's other ways to protect intellectual property that could lead to more consumer-friendly outcomes.
True, but I mean, patents go, I mean, that's in the Constitution.
I know.
Right? That's in the body of the Constitution.
But it's still regulation,
absolutely.
Which is not free.
Yeah,
trade.
But it's regulation from a group of people who are not very into regulation.
I know.
So
yep.
it just tells you, you know, where they put this. Right. I remember, patents were in the Constitution before the Bill of Rights was.
And you know, Alexander Hamilton was a huge proponent of state subsidies for industrial policy.
Cue the music.
That's right. Yes, cue the music. Bruce writes, so any extra money in consumers' pockets now offset by higher prices due to tariffs on aluminum and steel?
You know, the cost pass-through of
depends
a tariff.
Depends on how much beer you drink.
Yeah, right.
Aaron?
The cost.
I didn't think it's the beer thing. I didn't think the beer thing.
Maybe I'll switch to bottles or just start buying kegs.
It's a recycling opportunity.
Growlers.
Recycling,
yes.
Of aluminum and steel domestically. Sorry,
you know,
Aaron.
That's all right. The cost pass-through of the tariff, once it trickles down to individual consumer goods, will be fairly minor. Would be my guess.
And very attenuated, right? I mean,
yeah.
it's going to take time to filter and filtering
right.
through a series of things in the supply chain.
When you buy a car, you may notice it.
Right. I think the bigger point here is that if Trump is in favor of promoting domestic industry mm-hmm. and protecting U.S. workers, there are so many more productive outlets, and that is things like full employment policy, whether it's infrastructure projects, you know, government-guaranteed employment for the unemployed or government-sponsored job retraining to, you know, take workers who lose their jobs because of steel competition and train them for work in other growing fields, which is what, you know, most of the rest of the industrialized world does.
But he would argue that's what he's doing here, right?
Well,
he would argue is that he's freeing, he's making more jobs available in that industry.
Well, but there are other more productive and substantive ways to do that without triggering trade wars, I think.
Michael writes, the president may not realize that most of our steel imports come from Canada, following by Korea, Brazil, and then China. Anyway, it will take time to expand U.S. production capability for any product, and in the interim, we will have disruption and increased costs for consumers.
Maybe. A little. I mean, disruption is the way of the economic world right now, right?
Sure.
And increased, you know, costs will go up, and then, you know, people will, in a capitalistic society, people will search for better prices, and then costs will go down.
Susan writes, 3 weeks ago, I was going to buy a box of aluminum foil. It was priced at $6.99 for a store brand. I decided to wait till the following week to buy. And Wednesday, 6 days after I originally priced it, the box was $8.99, 30% increase before tariffs. Grocery store economic reality! !
She should have bought 50 boxes and then sold it on the street the following week.
Yes, that's exactly what she should have done.
You can see guys on the street hawking. Who needs aluminum foil?
Aluminum foil. Who knew?
Isn't that just like real good arbitrage or something?
Yeah, it's commodities arbitrage.
There you go.
Ellen says, does anyone have an opinion on subsidies instead of tariffs? I seem to remember that years ago there was an issue of a new process of manufacturing steel, and U.S. companies chose to not upgrade because it was too costly, and then mm-hmm. Germany became right. the major exporter of steel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Would it make sense to support domestic steel through subsidies and maybe do less onerous tariffs?
Absolutely. This is the point of having some type of focused industrial policy that Hamilton was in favor of, and that is you target industries and subsidize more efficient production techniques so they can compete and not trigger, you know, worldwide trade wars.
But part of that is, you're right, and I agree with you, and I agree with Hamilton. But I'm sure he'd be pleased to hear that. But then you have to cycle. What happens is then you have to kind of cycle through industries as you do that, right? Because there's an industrial cycle, and it'll be steel, and now it'll be kind of the byproducts of that.
Well, you also have to get into the tax code, where special interest lobbyists have slipped so many incentives. I mean, I'm so concerned about the economy of Puerto Rico, and one reason they're in a death spiral is because about 20, 25 years ago, Congress inserted this very sweet provision to encourage pharmaceuticals to manufacture in Puerto Rico. Congress then took it away, and that was a majority of the high-skilled jobs in Puerto Rico. So like 90% of the pharmaceutical companies there have been shuttered. That was like, you know, one paragraph in the tax code. And our tax code has, Aaron, you know, scores and scores of special favors for industries we've never heard of. So tariffs are just like the icing on the cake. If you go deeper, there's so much. I really don't think we have a free market at all.
I think you mean tip of the iceberg, not icing on the cake.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Okay. Thank you.
Because I don't see tariffs as icing on any cake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, we clearly don't have a we don't have a traditionally free market, right?
No,
I mean,
nothing close.
We have a managed market, and you could argue about how heavily managed versus lightly managed, and then that cycles through what we feel like managing.
Well, we criticize China for subsidizing their industries, and then here in the United States, there are tremendous hidden subsidies to favor. You know, that's why there are so many lobbyists and tax code lobbyists in Washington.
All right. We have just a few moments before we go over to a break, but I would like to get to another story, and that is regarding guns and what is happening there. We go to, again, the New York Times. You're welcome, Rich. NRA suggests Trump may retreat from gun control after a meeting in the Oval Office. The NRA's top lobbyist says that President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, quote, support strong due process and don't want gun control. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump tweeted about the meeting, calling it, quote, great.
Well, when I first saw the coverage of the meeting, the bipartisan meeting, my instant reaction was, oh, this is not going to last a week. You know, this is Chuck and Nancy on the Dreamers all over again. So the president brought the NRA in last night. I think the NRA made a strategic mistake by tweeting first and basically saying they've rolled the president back. But I don't see this president really using any political capital to get significant reductions in gun violence. There are 300 million guns on the street today. I mean, the Florida shooting was, what, almost 2 weeks ago. All Congress has done is a moment of silence and the bogus thoughts and prayers narrative. So I'm not at all surprised about this. And it's, you know, it's heartbreaking that the president can't use his leadership to get anything done.
Yeah. When I saw that story yesterday, my first thought was, okay, so what else is happening here? That seems really bizarre that he's going so far off of what he said in the past. And when I saw the summary of the meeting with the top NRA lobbyist, I was, oh, there it is. That's not surprising at all. And there are really vested interests, and the NRA is a huge one. And it's, you know, a sign of a weak president who can't find compromise and bring two groups together who obviously admit that this is some type of problem.
Meanwhile, the Senate said they're not going to take anything up, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But the high school students in Florida are still at it. They're organizing a big March for Our Lives on March 24th in Washington and all over the country. Hopefully there'll be some events in the Capital District. You know, I don't think these students believed what the president said a few days ago. They're gonna keep at it. And they've done something that no one else has done in this country recently, is they've kept the gun violence issue alive for two whole weeks.
I think he will. I still think something is going to happen on. I guess I'll say on security in general. I don't know. I feel like gun control will be a part of it. I still think there's going to be something done at the federal level. I hope it's legislative. I know he's already done some stuff with justice, you know, which is kind of, you know, around the edges. But I do think that he. You know, he is, you know, pushed back against, or is at least publicly pushed back against the NRA. I think the NRA has been, even for them, has been even more tone deaf than usual. And they're usually, I mean, they're usually good lobbyists. You know, they're usually good communicators. And I just feel like they've been, you know, really on the wrong side of this issue, which makes me think, when I, Aaron, when you said, you know, what's going on here, I think they're feeling something slipping away here. And I think that there's a little bit of desperation. I think that's why I think something will get done. I still think something's going to get done on immigration, too. I've predicted both of those, so I could be hopefully, you know, we'll see.
You know, thinking about the whole, you know, gun control in terms of what it means to have access to guns, I was thinking about what it takes to be able to drive a car. There's a strict age limit. Mm-hmm. There's instruction that goes along with it. There's testing that happens before you can legally drive a car. There are insurance regulations. There's federal policy on car safety, on speed limits. And, you know, that's fairly sensible regulation to keep the road safe so people aren't, you know, mowing each other down or rear-ending each other. And I just can't see why something similar and equally as rational can't be applied to something far more dangerous.
And then the one thing you left out is also there's sanctions on misuse.
Right,
I'll call them criminal. Certainly, governmental sanctions, and then they become money sanctions because your insurance goes up. And you know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of regulation like that at the.
I mean, there are sanctions for manslaughter and things like that, point taken.
States that have taken some steps to reducing gun violence, like New York and Connecticut, there's been a significant reduction in problems. New York City, for instance, has the lowest crime rate today than it had since the 1940s. And I think a lot of that can be traced to stricter gun laws in New York State. Governor Cuomo, who I disagree with quite a bit, deserves a lot of credit for pushing through the SAFE Act, because it got to the fundamental problem is the quantity of guns we have in this country. For every 100 Americans, there's 113 guns. So of course we're going to have these problems. So Rich, I think you're right. I think there will be something on school safety, which every parent will support. But I'm pessimistic that they're actually going to get to something that reduces the flow of guns.
I will say this. I've said it pretty much every day this week. I'll say it again. These kids are so inspiring and amazing to me. I know there's a lot of on the right are people are saying that they're being co-opted and people are
responsible on the right is saying that. I think people on the right are celebrating
them
what they're
and
doing.
Well, I hope you're right. They're being attacked for saying the things and then their parents are putting them up to them and so forth. But seeing these kids interviewed at length,
right,
and their grasp on the issue, and knowing the answers, and bringing up really good facts, and making comparisons to other issues, they're really, really smart, and they're also the ones living it. They're the ones who are going to school, and when you hear a kid say, "I have to walk to chemistry class mm-hmm. on the tiles where my friend died." Mm-hmm. That's compelling.
Oh, I think it's very compelling. I think I disagree with you, Joe. I think people on the right are celebrating, you know, what the kids are doing.
It's the opposite. I hope you're right, Rich.
You're talking about the far extreme people, but you talk about the everyday Fox News people.
What about Marco
people.
Rubio?
With Marco Rubio, I don't know where I put him. Okay.
Well, that's my point. I mean, that's who's doing it. The people that support
and the NRA
and the NRA.
But the NRA is just out there somewhere. And
this is your point about them being tone deaf.
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I think those kids are being celebrated, and I still continue to think something. But I will say, yes, it's very compelling, but it's just as compelling that. You know, this was because the amount of people who died in this last school shooting was what?
17.
2 weeks in Chicago, four weeks in Chicago.
Yeah. It's not just school,
right? So,
yeah.
So these kids. How many kids in Chicago are saying, "I have to on my way to school, I have to walk past the same sidewalk where my friend was shot down."
Well, I think these high school students who have most of them, it seems, it's a fairly affluent suburban school district.
But
they are making connections.
I think that's
with
part of it too.
People working against gun violence in Chicago and in New York City. This is a pretty savvy crew of students.
It
they
sure
know how
is.
They know how to connect with people. they are motivated. They don't want the 17 deaths to be in vain.
They
but I
are.
Think they're taking a much broader picture.
But they are, and listen, I'm the conservative here, okay?
Yeah, so
also,
play your role,
yeah,
damn it.
Right. But I think also, I think, you know, part of this is they have a voice and a platform that I don't know that the kids in Chicago do.
Right.
I agree with you.
And I'm not taking anything away from what these kids are doing. I think it's great, but I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the same thing's going on every day in cities throughout America.
You are absolutely right. The one difference being that that it was one kid with one gun and 17 deaths.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the horrible tragedy in Las Vegas, that kind of vanished in like two news cycles. But what I'm so disappointed in Congress for is obviously not acting other than a moment of silence. But remember, they were shot at when they were doing their baseball playing in Alexandria, Virginia. Steve Scalise landed in the hospital, unfortunately, for a long period of time. They were on the receiving end of the bullets, and they've not changed a bit from their own experience.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue and move on to some other thoughts. Judith Ankus here, Aaron Pacitti, and Rich Honan. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And hey, Judith Ank, what are you going to be up to this weekend?
Well, tomorrow I will be driving down to the Hudson Valley to speak at an Indivisible meeting.
Yes.
Looking forward to meeting some new friends there. I'm going to be speaking about the Trump assault on the environment. It's in Millbrook at Charlotte's Restaurant. So that's tomorrow, Saturday at 4. And then next Wednesday, I'm really looking forward to going over to see my friends in Bennington College, where they are sponsoring my talk on the Trump assault on the environment and what you can do about it. What people may not realize is Bennington is only an hour from Albany. So that is Wednesday, March 7th at 7 o'clock. Free and open to the public, so come on by to either event.
Also a beautiful campus.
Oh, my gosh. I love Bennington College.
Yeah, it's a beautiful
and great
college.
Students. I've been working with them on the PFOA issue in Hoosick Falls and Petersburg, which is really why I'm going over there. They've been so terrific on the drinking water issues. So great students. Really looking forward to that conversation.
You guys want to plug anything? No?
I'm not.
Got nothing?
I did speak at Albany High School last week, and there were two. It was great, but there were two things going on. There was one thing on leadership, and one thing on Black History Month. And I showed up, and you know, security was tight as it should be. And I check in, and the woman's not looking at me. She's looking down. She said, "Are you here for Black History Month?" And I said, "You know, do I look like I? You know, I'm happy to talk about my experiences. You know, I'm happy to share them. But I don't know that how edifying it's going to be."
So you went to your leadership,
right? Meeting. And by the way, the kid. You speak at people at all levels of I speak at colleges and graduate school and law schools. The high school kids are so smart.
Oh mm-hmm. man,
they don't give you an inch.
Right.
You know they will call you out on stuff.
That's great. All right, let's go to some letters, then we'll move on to some other stuff. Martin says, "Hey, Judith hit the nail on the head. This is not a policy. It's a distracting." This is about trade. "This is not a policy. It's a distracting piece of red meat to draw attention away from Hope Hicks and Jared Kushner. Nothing he says, Trump, I assume, can be trusted, and I doubt this tariff will ever happen. Are transgender people banned from the military? Question mark."
According to Secretary Mattis, no.
Yeah.
They're not going to follow the president's directive on that.
Catherine writes, "My question is, how many jobs will really come back to the U.S.? Will manufacturers just use the tax breaks for new equipment purchases to buy robots that will do the work and just a few techs to monitor those systems?"
Yeah, and hopefully the robots at least will be manufactured here.
Yeah,
that's that's a win in this economy.
Stacy writes this email with the subject line, "Corporate patience." Right, Rich, the high turnover in the Trump administration is due to the president running the government like a corporation. It's not because those people, one, couldn't get approved, two, lied on their filings for the jobs, three, were revealed as tax evaders or otherwise corrupt, four, were revealed as domestic abusers, five, were actually honest people who fled when they saw what was going on. The fact that you feel the need to cover that up
as the president and getting rid of people who aren't working out because he's trying to run a good corporation is laughable.
I said in the beginning they made some bad calls in the beginning. I think if you look at the facts, you'll see that he's also had the least amount of positions, you know, confirmed by Congress.
Well, he hasn't nominated
right.
them.
Yeah, he hasn't filled
so
them.
So many because few it, have been nominated.
And he also knows. I think he also knows. You know where those are going to go. But I think he's concentrating on the people at the top. And I'm not defending all of his decisions, even at the people at the top.
But I really think people are leaving. Either they're getting fired or they're embarrassed. It's not just, you know, burnout of 1 year of really hard work. And I read something yesterday that when people leave, usually when you leave the White House, that's great on your resume. You get many, many job offers. You get picked up. The phrase is you monetize your government service, something that I have failed to do. But these folks cannot get jobs. I mean, what's Sean Spicer doing? I read an article yesterday that this is a stain on their resume, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I think all those people will be working and working very profitably over the next
year or
so.
Well, they're welcomed back at Goldman Sachs, but, you know, especially the communications people. What is Sean Spicer doing?
I don't know. But see, this is the thing is that, you know, for a business and managers, turnover is really bad for business. Lowers morale. You have to, you lose the institutional memory that goes along with that. There's just a lack of information about who reports to who. The efficiency and productivity of workers goes down. All of this is very costly in terms of politics of getting things done. In business, it's more about, you know, making money. Yeah. But I don't understand why a businessman can't see that this much turnover is bad for.
Well, that is how he's run his business.
Well, true, but I don't think this is how he would have chosen it.
He should change whatever he's doing to prevent it from happening.
But Aaron, part of it is that, you know, you first of all, you pick people with skill sets, and some people can't handle the different. The different focus, the different visibility, you know, because when you're in business, you're kind of invisible, you
sure.
know, and
okay.
and some people can't handle that. I think to the last letter writer, I would say you cannot. The amount of leaks that have come out of here, I think that has a lot to do with people being fired and people being asked to leave and things like that. And I think we're seeing less of it. And I think
except
that's part
this
of it.
Past week, I think the Jared Ivanka part of the White House is feuding with the Kelly part of the White House, and the leaks are way up. But Rich, you work at a law firm. Can you imagine if a third of your colleagues either got fired or quit in the last year, or at Siena College, a third of the Siena staff left in 1 year? It'd be very disruptive.
Yeah, I agree. I also think at the beginning of an administration, I think that you're going to see that. This was a disruptive election that promised mm-hmm. disruptive things, and, you know, the draining of the swamp. And it might be that the White House, you know, even the people he brought in could, you know, end up being part of that swamp.
We have to take a break, and during the break, all of the listeners and all of us can just think about that for a moment of the third of the people that we work with that we would like to have leave.
I
think about that.
I was going to say that, except I was afraid who was listening. You know? My managing partner is listening right now saying, I wish that Rich was one of those one
third. We're all unemployed.
Yeah. All right. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We learned during the break that Leonard Cohen born in Canada.
I told you.
I'm blown away.
Murals all over Montreal, according to my friends Mark and Margaret.
I didn't know it was that Leonard Cohen. I thought it was the other Leonard Cohen from Montreal.
So just so you know what we talk about during the breaks, that would be it. A couple letters, then we'll get on to some other topics, and we're having fun today. We'll finish out. Michael says, concentrate, Rich. Great panel all. Something just really pricked my ears. I heard Rich use three words in a row regarding the president. I think he's concentrating. No, he's not, Rich, on anything.
Okay.
Brucey says Chicago is the right's
Trump's favorite city to point at. It's well known that guns in Chicago are traveling there on a guns pipeline from surrounding states, bringing up Chicago as essentially a dog whistle pointing at black-on-black crime as the real problem. That is certainly not what you were doing in that.
So how do you even have a conversation where that's the response? You know, I'm talking about how people in underprivileged or underserved neighborhoods don't have the voice that people maybe in rich suburban neighborhoods do, even in the face of tragedy. And that's considered a racist remark. How do you even respond to that?
I agree with Rich on that one.
I agree with you, too. Denise says, in reference to Judith's disappointment that Congress hasn't addressed gun violence even after facing down bullets on the battlefield, on the ball field, I really think that they are so owned and cowed by the gun lobby that they would rather face down bullets than the NRA.
Yeah, and that's why John Faso and Elise Stefanik have an A rating from the NRA.
Pamela says, I'm appalled that Rich thinks Black History Month is only for Black people. When did you say that?
I knew somebody was going to have a problem with that.
No, I meant that perhaps I'm not the authority to speak on you know the Black experience in America.
Meaning there were two conferences going on at the same day,
right.
And you were okay. Right. Just forget it. All right, never mind. Although
I'm happy to. If somebody wants
Rich,
me to speak about
love
it, I'm
you.
Happy to talk about
you,
my experience.
And you would be good at Corporate Lawyer Month, which is every month.
Oh.
I'm good at academic month, which is 8 months of the year.
I was going to say that's only half the
year, academic
year,
not summer or holidays.
All right, let's go.
I'm sorry, I should not have said that.
I'm glad somebody said good and corporate law in the same sentence. Regarding me, I'll take that.
I didn't say that. I just said it's Corporate Lawyer Month. Okay.
I chose this story because I don't know exactly what this is, and I didn't know it was an issue, and I knew that Judith would. So tell us about coal ash waste and why the EPA is moving to overhaul the safeguards put in place by the Obama administration.
Oh, this is heartbreaking, Joe. I know all about coal ash,
okay,
unfortunately.
I figure you do.
That is the way I roll. So when you burn coal, you have a lot of ash. Everyone knows that. And unfortunately, the ash is loaded with heavy metals, cadmium, mercury, lead. And the coal companies, the power plants, tend to just dig holes in the ground or create lagoons where the ash goes. So the Obama administration took some very, very modest steps to require liners in the waste pits, to require more inspections, more monitoring. And surprise, surprise, Scott Pruitt, the worst EPA administrator in history, is rolling back those regulations. So it is really bad news for communities that have coal plants still operating. Their rivers are impacted. Their groundwater is impacted. Instances of people having their drinking water contaminated. And I think the bigger issue is we're all following the shiny thing in the White House, the Trump administration, but at the federal agencies, there is a revolution going on, and I mean revolution in a bad way. Just in 1 year at the EPA, Scott Pruitt has repealed 20 major environmental regulations, and he's in the process of rolling back 47 additional regulations. And this is not just about bean counting. This is about, do we have heavy metals in drinking water? Are we going to breathe dirtier air? And I think the coal ash issue is emblematic of just this deep, deep problem. These policies are not only bad for the environment, but really, really bad for public health. My final point is Congress needs to exercise some oversight authority, and they're not. They'll vote when bills come to the floor, but they rarely pull Scott Pruitt in and say, you know what these policies are going to do to the Adirondacks or the Hudson Valley. A few days ago, a national environmental group, League of Conservation Voters, came out with their annual scorecard. John Faso in 2017 has a 37% voting record, Stefanik 43%, Tonko 100%. I was surprised Claudia Tenney was down at 6%, and I thought, oh my gosh, she must be the lowest in the state. But no, Chris Collins is at 3%, and Schumer and Gillibrand both at 100%. So there's the votes on the floor, but there's also why aren't these members of Congress, I'm not saying in a dramatic hearing setting, but why isn't, you know, Elise Stefanik, who knows how important it is not to have acid rain be a growing problem in the Adirondacks, why isn't she going in and meeting with Pruitt and saying, your dirty air policies are really damaging my district? It's just not happening.
But I think what committees have oversight?
Well, there's Environment and Public Works in the Senate, which Senator Gillibrand thankfully is on. And
right.
She's been an amazing voice for the residents of Hoosick Falls and Petersburg on the drinking water issue. And on the House side, it's there's an Energy Committee, and then there's, a Natural Resources Committee.
Yeah. I thought it would be Energy, but then I didn't know if Natural Resources had some kind of sway there.
One of the issues I don't like about the way the rhetoric of regulation is that it's always portrayed as job-killing regulation, mm-hmm. that this is going to hurt the coal industry. But government regulation frequently creates as many jobs as it destroys. It just happens to be in other sectors. So the example Judith gave about using liners in this, well, that creates jobs the manufacturing of those liners. And there's the added benefit that people don't have to drink contaminated water. So it really bothers me to hear all of these regulations talked about as job killing, because there's always a plus side to that, and that is industries that come in to do the regulation or to provide the raw materials for that. It creates jobs in those areas, and on net, it turns out to be about even.
And beyond that, you know, if you really care about job creation, you look at the energy sector. Coal is dying. It just is. It's on its last legs. Far more jobs are created from renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal. If all you care about is job creation, you should be committed to 100% renewables.
And the funny thing about the decline of the coal industry, I shouldn't say funny, it's not funny. Perhaps the ironic thing is that it comes from deregulating the ways to extract natural gas from hydrofracking,
yeah.
And that's made it so much more competitive in terms of power sources than coal. It's not job-killing regulations. It's the fact that you have deregulation in another area that is making fuel substantially cheaper.
And arguably, in some ways, just as dirty.
Oh, well, absolutely.
Environmentally dirty.
I'm not saying it's better or worse. It's just
You look at methane from fracking. Methane mm-hmm. is 14 times more potent than CO2. And yet, ironically, here in our own backyard, Governor Cuomo says he is committed to clean energy. He wants to divest from fossil fuels at the old Sheridan Avenue Answers incinerator power plant in Arbor Hill. Governor Cuomo put $80 million, and the legislature approved it in last year's state budget, to build a gas microturbine with fracked gas. We would have fracked gas powering the state capitol in the Empire State Plaza, according to the New York Power Authority, rather than investing in geothermal and solar and a clean energy mix. So if we care about climate change and the life cycle impacts of fracking, here's a local issue that everyone needs to jump on.
This gets back to the whole tariff issue and having some type of sensible industrial policy that has the ability to create jobs in new sectors or growing sectors instead of trying to save, you know, sectors that are dying. Economists call that creative destruction. And in a perfectly free market economy, it's creative because it leads to new, more productive industries, but it has tremendous destructive effects. That can be managed, and it should be managed through industrial policy like Germany and Japan and most of the industrialized world do.
But the government has been singularly bad at picking those industries and then resourcing those industries. Even under the Obama administration, they tried to do that with energy and made a series of not great bets on it. I don't know that government is, while government has to provide the resource, I don't think the government is the vehicle to make those decisions.
Well, many Republicans are famous for saying they don't want to pick winners and losers, but they do that every day.
They're exactly. picking coal.
Yeah, right. They're picking coal. And this is this coal ash rule. You may think, oh, it doesn't really affect me. I don't live near a coal plant. But it does, because it's propping up the coal industry, all the carbon pollution, all the nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide that comes from it. You know, one thing I'm really worried about, just one, is since the EPA was established 48, 49 years ago, there's been a gradual improvement in environmental conditions. If you look at the trajectory, many could argue it's not fast enough. But our air gets cleaner, our water gets cleaner. I can't say that on climate change. CO2 emissions are out of control. But for the first time, we're going to see a reversal. So due to EPA and New York State DEC work, for instance, acid rain in the Adirondacks and Catskills has been down by 70%. I think we're going to see a reversal. We're going to see more acid rain.
Pauline writes us and says, why is everyone picking on Rich? I do not agree with him a lot, but man, putting words in his mouth is not fair. Rich, you are a joy to have on the roundtable. We're glad we have an outside voice so we can try to understand the point of view. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very
nice to say. Is that Aunt Pauline?
Thank you, Aunt Pauline. Thank you very much.
Gotta get it in, don't you, Judith? All right.
No, I agree with Pauline. I think a diversity of views makes the show much better. And otherwise, we love Rich.
That's the other nice thing. Yeah.
We don't want to be the Fox News of the left.
No.
That makes me the Juan Williams of...
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
All right. What else can we talk about in our 3 minutes that we have left? We can remind people about your event.
Yeah. So tomorrow I will be speaking at the Indivisible meeting at Charlotte's Restaurant in Millbrook at 4 o'clock, and then Bennington College on Wednesday at 7. Kind of the same speech, the Trump assault on the environment and what you can do about it.
Okay, and anybody else have anything else they want to talk about?
I will say we sponsored a really terrific event a couple of weeks ago at the Linda, put on by a group called Women with Voices. So go to Women with Voices LLC. This group puts on plays that address social issues and had a terrific performance at the Linda a couple of weeks ago, and just different ways of communicating social social issues. Very, very interesting. Women with Voices LLC.
Sounds right up my alley.
Actually,
Women
you should
voices.
Check it out.
Good stuff.
I'll be grading midterms if people want to come watch that.
And since we're kind of killing time, I want to say I went viral yesterday with a tweet.
So what was the tweet? How did you go viral? And how powerful do you feel right now?
Just a little. So my Twitter handle is ENCKJ. Please follow me on Twitter. And my son, who's a journalist, told me that I can get to 10,000 followers in my first year on Twitter, which I didn't believe. And so I looked at my numbers yesterday, and I was at just under 2,000. And overnight, I added like over 400 new followers because I did, I think, a pretty good tweet that said something like, I was in the Obama administration. I never flew first class. I never bought furniture. I never told white lies. I never abused my spouse. We just worked hard. I just kind of like, you know, threw it out there, and I think someone with influence, who I'll never know, retweeted, and I've gone viral.
That's very cool. Congratulations.
I will pass that on to my two followers.
I think
my son and my daughter.
I think they're two wonderful followers, and
she
I'll
will gladly
you.
Take them. Yeah, gladly take them.
I have to get to 10,000.
And finally, the Oscars are Sunday night. Anybody have any predictions, any thoughts,
Is Lady Bird nominated?
Yes.
Oh, my favorite. So that means they won't win.
Probably not. Three Billboards and Shape of Water seem to be the two favorites.
Three Billboards.
Is that the Frances McDormand?
Yeah.
Everybody says she was just terrific.
Oh, she's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, I watched that again last night. Good stuff. All right. My thanks to everybody for coming in the snow and for making it a quite lovely morning. And I thank you. Be safe going out. That is both to our panelists and to our listeners. Thank you very much for being with us. We will continue our program right after this short break.